Ladies and gentlemen, what did you think of President Obama's presentation this morning? Was it a great presentation?
Yeah.
Some people have said that in these times, with two wars, with the economic crisis, that we can't have a conservation agenda, but I think President Obama laid that to rest this morning. We will have a conservation agenda for the 21st century that we can be proud of, and we may, in fact, surpass the legacy of Teddy Roosevelt. Okay, we may, in fact, do that. We have a great panel, and we will run through this very quickly, but we also have one of our great honored guests, and all of you are honored here today. We could have had 50,000 people together here today, but we basically brought in the people who we thought were the leaders that are going to make this happen in the 21st century. And I want, at the outset, before we hear from the panel, to hear from the great-grandson of the wilderness warrior, who in his own right has become one of the leading conservationists of America and the globe, and that is Teddy Roosevelt IV. Teddy Roosevelt.
Thank you. Thank you.
I like all my cabinet colleagues, you know how we are. This is really a unity agenda. He's a great Republican.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. It's not often that a Roosevelt is at loss for words. But I've been incredibly moved listening to the panels, the speakers this morning. And what they've done is they've thrown down a challenge that's come from the White House and from the President himself. Our generation must rise and meet this challenge, because we cannot pass on to the next generation the great outdoors, our great public lands, impoverished. We have to reinvigorate the lands, make the connections between youth and our public lands. But this is a challenge that we can meet, and I hope that we can exceed my great-grandfather's legacy. And if we can do that, we will hold our heads high with pride. So I look forward to working with all of you, and the idea that we're going to engage with each other and we're going to create partnerships and work is a magnificent challenge, and we can do this together. So thank all of you for being here.
Thank you, Teddy. Thank you very much. Thank you for doing this for us.
And let me also, at this point, just say one more time, Secretary Vilsack is a wonderful champion for rural America. He and I have this conversation all the time, and we do it in the White House, that we are really in the renaissance of rural America with the broadband efforts, with all of the other efforts that he has on biofuels and a whole host of other things that are an important agenda for that forgotten America. So to Secretary Vilsack, to Mayor Booker, to Ray McCormick, to Jamie Pinkham and to Lynn Sherrod and to Doug Brinkley, let's give that prior panel a round of applause for their great contribution. Thank you a lot, Tom. And we have a distinguished panel today. I'm going to call first on the governor of New Mexico, Bill Richardson, who has given his life and his heart to the betterment of this country, to making it a more perfect union from his days as a young man, moving forward to become the member of the United States House of Representatives, to the Ambassador of the United States, the United Nations, the Secretary of Energy, to Governor Extraordinaire for the State of New Mexico, to the Chairman of the Democratic National Convention, and the list could go on. Governor Bill Richardson from the Land of Enchantment. Bill Richardson.
Thank you, Secretary Salazar. I noticed that the introductions get nicer as I approach the end of my term. But that was, this is a glorious day. I'm overwhelmed by the energy, enthusiasm, and commitment of so many of you, and the president, and the great green cabinet. You know, when I was running for president, I noticed, Ken, you didn't mention that. And even today, the national dialogue on environmental issues was almost focused entirely on energy conservation, renewable energy. Absent were debates that we're having today about the preservation of land, of air, water, wildlife issues, Native Americans, trails, and this is why this conference is so timely. We need new outdoor initiatives that retain the basics and core of conservation. And I'm going to talk about them today. Expanding our wilderness systems and parks, protecting our air, water, and habitat. The basics, the Mo Udall, the Stuart Udall, the Bruce Babbitt agendas that were so worthy of American support. And now with Ken Salazar emerging as somebody that is driving this excellent agency into another period of excellence. And as a Western governor, I know firsthand the challenges we face, preserving America's vast natural resources, our wildlife, our landscapes. But I also know that with federal agencies and states working together, along with private landowners, farmers, ranchers, individuals, as Secretary Vilsack championed so well, we have tremendous opportunities to accomplish great things. That's why I, as a Western governor, am calling on a new federal partnership between the state and the federal government on the outdoors, one that has not existed for a long time. Instead of worrying about turf and jurisdiction, we should concentrate on dialogue and joint efforts. While states like mine have a wealth of knowledge on habitat and conservation priorities and on-the-ground political realities within their borders, it's federal agencies like the Department of Interior, Agriculture, EPA, that have national vision and greater human and financial resources, particularly the men and women, like here in Interior, that work every day in the career service to foster conservation. We have to work together to develop landscape conservation legacies that include a new series of parks, new monuments, new management strategies for public lands. This isn't a decades-long fight. It should happen now. What do we need first? I would say an omnibus wilderness bill. Wilderness legislation consolidated. The San Juan Mountains Wilderness Act in Colorado. The Barry Saya Snow Mountain National Conservation in California. The bills to provide Ute Mountain and Rio Grande del Norte, as well as the Oregon Mountains in New Mexico, and other proposed landscape protections in Arizona and Idaho and Nevada and across the West. Secretary Salazar has wasted no time in protecting treasured landscapes working in partnerships with the states. I urge the Interior Department to move forward quickly on its expanded National Monument Plan, and I commend Secretary Salazar for engaging the governors early on this initiative. After all, it is the governors that have most of the power. That's supposed to be funny. You know, in New Mexico, I'm looking forward to working with this department on creating a national monument on Otero Mesa. Other sites in the West that the Interior Department has identified as potential monuments deserve national and congressional support as well. Otero Mesa is the largest intact expanse of Chihuahuan desert grassland in the United States and was nearly sacrificed to energy exploration before the state of New Mexico and a strong coalition of conservation groups stepped in and halted the drilling. Now it needs permanent protection, which can only be accomplished through a permanent federal designation. And as we look for opportunities to protect our treasures, we must seek environmental agreements with the First Americans, the Native American tribes in the West, instead of always kind of forgetting them. The tribes are major landowners and responsible stewards of the environment. Some years ago, when I was in the Congress, I successfully sponsored legislation to create a joint Indian federal park on the Zuni Reservation. While ultimately the park didn't become reality, this is the type of project that should be encouraged throughout the West. Another issue for enhanced state-federal cooperation, not at the top of the media radar screen, the fate of America's wild mustangs. I'm working on establishing a state wild horse preserve in my state, But we will need flexibility from the BLM in order to succeed. We're exploring options with one of our Native American pueblos for a park that would exist on a combination of pueblo and adjacent lands. New Mexico has several herds of homeless wild horses, and we want to give them a refuge where future generations can see them roam on the western landscape. And I commend the Secretary's initiative on wild Mustangs, but we need the BLM to better understand state needs to preserve these icons that are so much a part of America. Another major challenge facing our nation is wildlife habitat fragmentation. Last year, Governor Bill Ritter of Colorado and I established a wildlife corridor initiative along our shared New Mexico-Colorado border. What we're seeing along our border is that large tracts of private lands are being carved into ranchettes that impede mule deer and elk migrations. This fragmentation is also a predictable result of new roads and unbridled development. President Obama and Senator Jeff Bingaman have called for $450 million for the Land and Water Conservation Fund for key conservation and land acquisition programs at the Departments of Interior and Agriculture. If the call for full funding is met, it'll be historic, because while this fund was established by Congress more than 40 years ago, it's only been funded fully for two of those years. It's also vitally important that we reestablish an equitable split of LWCF funds between the federal government and the states. States like mine have programs to leverage federal dollars to purchase conservation easements, expand trails, and fund river restoration projects that are so important to our ecosystem. I also encourage the federal government to work with the states on a new set of river and stream protections, including increased funding for river restoration and a new list for wild and scenic river proposals for Congress. Rivers and streams are the backbones of ecosystems. Access to water and rich soils mean that these areas are likely to be more expensive and therefore underrepresented in existing protected public land. So we have to become creative if we're to craft a conservation map that both offers resilience for climate change and for ongoing land development trends. We should use all our tools at our disposal and protect the wildest places against degradation. Finally, our conservation efforts must not stop at our coasts. The health and welfare of our national resources, our coastal wildlife refuge, and so much of our nation's fish and wildlife resources are ultimately connected to the health of the ocean. We need a new national ocean policy, with the Interior Department playing more of a leadership role in conjunction with other federal agencies in developing science-based marine spatial planning, offshore ecosystem assessments, and protections similar to those we have on land. The United States must also push forward at international forums on protections for whales and other endangered species, despite recent setbacks at the United Nations. Traditionally, domestic agencies like the Interior Department must think more globally, since many of our environmental challenges are international in scope. In conclusion, really, I want to repeat my call for a bold set of actions. We need an omnibus wilderness bill, a series of new national parks and monuments, expansion of our trail system, partnerships with Native American governments, wild horse protections, wild and scenic river designations, ocean ecosystems assessments, and conservation funding. We cannot afford to wait. And as a man who held this important job as the nation's top environmental steward, Stuart Udall of New Mexico, once said, quote, "Over the long haul of this planet, it is the ecologists, not the bookkeepers of business, who are the ultimate accountants." Thank you very much.
Well done. Governor Richardson, thank you for your presentation and your great ideas. We agree with most of them. But you were never shy. All right, I'm going to introduce the rest of the panelists, and then what I've asked the panelists to do is to very briefly give us a quick overview of what they see the greatest challenges that we face in conservation and how we're going to resolve them. The first of our panelists is Bill Cronin. He is a professor of history and geography and environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Next to him is Sally Jewell, who is the chairman of the board and CEO of REI, which operates in more than half of the nation with thousands and thousands of employees. And next to her is Gary Myers. Gary is the former executive director of the Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency, but also one of the people who spawned the whole notion of landscape conservation cooperatives and was one of the leaders who inspired Sam Hamilton to bring those ideas to this administration. And next to Gary Myers is Ernesto Pepito, who is the youth program director at the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy. So with that, let's start with you, Bill, and we'll just go one at a time. Give us a short comment, and then we'll come back and we'll hone in on some specific issues. So, Bill, let's give them all a round of applause, you know? Good. You know, other than Bill Richardson, they're not getting paid anything. And even with Bill Richardson, he's just going to get a lunch. So anyway, thank you very much. Go ahead, Bill.
So when I think of the challenges that are facing us today, I often think of conservation as being first and foremost about the conservation of values, shared values. And as I think about the political challenges we face in the 21st century, continuing this great American project of conservation, remembering those values, passing on those values, seems to me to be one of the most important challenges that we take on. We're at a moment, I think, Americans have always been partisan. We've always been divided from each other. But we are at a moment when our partisanship is so extreme sometimes that it's easy for people to forget that on this question of protecting that which we have inherited from those who come before, this land which is the foundation of our national identity, to think that that isn't a shared value, that that isn't something that we must work together on, strikes me actually as our greatest challenge. And it is one that is part of, I think, our DNA as a nation. We are a country that was born in the 18th century at a moment when the legitimacy of government, the legitimacy of the state, was seen as inhering in the divine rights of kings. And the creation of this republic was about rejecting that notion of the divine rights of kings and instead finding the foundation of legitimate government in two things, which are really the creation of the 19th century in which this nation, arguably more than any other, showed the watchway for nations around the world. One was finding legitimacy in the people rather than in the crown. And the story of the people's struggle for freedom and liberty and a shared identity, a shared national inheritance, was one part of that. And then strikingly also, the core romantic project of the 19th century, the notion that the people's inheritance was the land and the nation's identity, its patriotism, inhered in the land. And that story of the American people, no matter how diverse their backgrounds, whether they were Native Americans here being invaded by people from all around the world, immigrants coming from all over the world, people coming here both willing and unwilling in many, many ways, but eventually forging their national identity in making this land their own and finding a home here. That story of our history and our nature woven together to make the story of the American people, that's, I think, finally what conservation is all about. And that is certainly what Teddy Roosevelt was about when he called that Congress together in 1908 and created the precursor for what we have here. Which is why the story, we're sitting here in Interior and just to our south is the National Mall. Due south is the Jefferson Memorial with its words that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and that all human beings are created equal, are part of that national heritage. And then farther to the west, Lincoln's Memorial, where the better angels of our nature kept the Union together by remembering what we shared in common. And the speech that was given in 1963 that Corey referred to of we have a dream together. It's a shared dream. And that dream is about the land. It's the land that we hold privately as stewards so that we can pass it on to our children, that we hold as tribes so that we can pass it on to the seventh generation, that we hold not as government land but as the people's land, held in common for all of us, so that the nation as a whole holds together by sustaining that land, to use not the 21st century word sustain, but Teddy Roosevelt's early 20th century word, to pass that land on undiminished, to pass the land on undiminished so that future generations will enjoy it. And then the only other thing I'd add, and I'll stop with this, is I think one of our greatest challenges is reconnecting urban people, especially young people, to a land that they often don't feel very connected to. And remembering that nature is not just out there in deep wilderness or in magnificent parks like Yosemite or Yellowstone, but right in Newark, New Jersey, right in every place that all of us live, and remembering that we are always in nature in all of those places, and holding that together, remembering how to share and pass on that vision. That's our greatest challenge.
All right, Bill Corn. Sally Jewell, among other things, also is on the Second Century Commission for the National Parks and a whole host of other things. Sally Jewell.
Thank you. You're a tough act to follow, Bill. Well, I want to start by telling you a little story about something that I was made aware of not too long ago. And I was shown a picture of a boy running away from a wave crashing on the beach in California. And the story of this boy is that he couldn't sit still in school. He was considered a slow learner, just wasn't able to get it. It's a black and white picture. And he was fortunate to have a mother that said, let's pull you out of school and let's put you in nature school. And that boy was Ansel Adams in your lobby here with the pictures. So I think about that story and think what he would have been diagnosed with today would be ADHD. He would have been given Ritalin and probably asked to still try and sit still in the classroom. Rich Louv, in his book, Last Child in the Woods, talks about many of the challenges that our children face today that Mayor Booker so eloquently talked about. And we do have large challenges, type 2 diabetes in children, inactivity, and so on. And so I want to draw on some of our work at REI in terms of, is this cutting in and out? Okay. Well, I'll just keep talking. I'll try and talk loud. We look at long-term trends, not as challenges necessarily, but just things that are. Things like urbanization. So when we think about urbanization as a business that connects people to nature, we're asking ourselves, how do we bring the outdoors into people's everyday lives? We talk about demographic shifts in the population. The population is changing rapidly, and the fastest growing segments of the population have not felt invited into our public lands in the way that the majority population over the years traditionally has. So that's an opportunity to reconnect people with our public lands that they haven't felt welcome on for one reason or another. Technology, which has tied us to the electrical outlet, has potentially a way to liberate us as we look forward into the future. And maybe the mother of all long-term trends that hasn't been talked about too much, but is a big, big factor for work in conservation, and that is climate change. The climates are changing, and our public lands and our open spaces are critically important to dealing with that. So I want to draw on one of the stories that I heard as a commissioner on the Second Century Commission, and there's a report called Advancing the National Park Idea, which is the work of this commission, co-chaired by former Senators Bennett Johnston and Howard Baker, who were terrific stewards of this. The most famous member of the commission would be Sandra Day O'Connor, and she was terrific. But there were heroes we heard from all across this country as we visited national parks. And the one example I want to draw from, which is in this report, is about the Santa Monica Mountains National Recreation Area. It's actually not a national park. It's a national recreation area. The Park Service has a relatively small park. It is a partnership of the National Park Service, of the California State Parks, of the Ventura Unified School District and the LA Unified School District, of community partners and conservation organizations, of private landowners who have worked in this beautiful natural area in proximity to 14 million people, the second largest Population Center, representing urbanization in this country. The National Park Service has the largest cadre of educators of any national park unit, and I was shocked to find out that's six. The National Park Service provided the funds for the bus transportation to get children from LA and Ventura out into the Santa Monica Mountains because they wouldn't get out there if somebody didn't pay for the buses, and that was referenced earlier. I saw children who had adopted a square meter of earth, and that became their square meter, and they were removing invasive species and planting native species. And these are children who lived within a 15-minute walk of the beach and had never set foot in the ocean. So these are solutions that are happening right now, and they're happening because of some very courageous public servants and some courageous landowners. There's lots of inholdings within the Santa Monica Mountains working cooperatively to create wildlife habitat for wild cougars, which they're tracking with GPSs, which the children can see. They can see the tracks, they can see where they've been, and sometimes they can actually see a cougar. It's a great example of what I think are both the challenges we have to these long-term trends and some of the solutions that are being done with really courageous public servants, because it's hard to be Woody Smeck as superintendent of that park, trying to work and forge these partnerships with an agency that needs to help work to support those partnerships. So I commend you to this report. There's a lot of solutions in this context of the national parks that really apply to urban parks, state parks, and local parks. And one of the greatest challenges that we need to address, and Governor Richardson certainly touched on that, and that is funding. If these parks are so critical to us and to our ecosystems, we need to find ways to support them over the long term and to recognize their value as a solution to climate change and as a solution to urbanization and as a solution to demographic shifts in the population and connecting to a sense of place. So I just have to say that the challenges that we all face as a nation on conservation got a lot easier this morning. So thank you very much to our two secretaries, our administrator, our chair, and our president, because what a shot in the arm that we've been waiting for. So thanks. It's going to get easier for you.
Gary Myers, on the ground, longtime wildlife enthusiast, conservationist, state director, leader.
Thank you. The thing that worries me is the potential loss of significant amounts of habitat. From a wildlife point of view, they've got to have it. And I saw some time ago one of these satellite images of what the country looks like at night with all the lights on. And they've done this thing like so you can look at it 10 years ago, 10 years before that, 10 years before that, 10 years into the future and on into the future. I think to like up to 2050 or something. And when I saw that, my reaction was, I don't want to be a director in charge of wildlife when we get to 2050. It was all lights. You're going to be managing the wildlife that we have left between the houses or in people's backyards if you live in the East. And I'm thinking, how in the world can they do that? And then it hits you that they're going to have to be playing with that kind of an environment unless we do something here and now today to hand them a different environment. And the first thing that comes to your mind is, well, we need to just zone things so that as the population expands and they'll move into the right places and not into the wrong places. If you live in the South, you kind of know that there's a fierce feeling that I have every right to do with my land as I please, and nobody's going to tell me what to do. And that's a hard battle to fight. The easiest way to get there from here is to put it in public ownership, if you're talking about a public land base. And we need that public land base. We better do it now, because if we wait, it'll be gone. We won't be able to do it. Now, what's impacting all of that is complicated by climate change. And it's going to be complicated probably with water shortages and other issues that are very difficult to deal with. And it's going to take a ton of money to do that stuff. So where do you get the money? This is a bad time, but we've got to have the money. And it's billions of dollars is what is really needed if you're going to do this thing right. And what you're going to have to do, I think, is look at the big picture, figure out what the landscapes are that are important to future generations, important to the economy, important to agriculture and to forestry. There's a study that shows that we're going to lose millions of acres of forest by 2030 in the South. What lives in the forest? What do those forests provide for the economy, for the people? What are we doing to ensure the future of those forests? We have to be thinking about that, and we need to be thinking about it today and doing something about it today. And so if I had to deal with that kind of a problem and come up with a solution, I would need a Secretary of Interior that believed in landscape scale things. You would really need a partnership between the Secretary of Interior and the Secretary of Agriculture. And it'd be nice to get the Department of Defense engaged in some of this. And, but could that ever happen? You know, I've been in this business for 35 years, messing around at sort of the national level from a wildlife point of view. I've never seen an opportunity like that. And then to have a president actually show at a meeting like this, that's unbelievable. And to get him to say what he said.
Thank you, Gary. And now to our youngest member of the panel, champion for your youth.
Thank you. When I think of challenges, the first thing that comes to mind is relevancy when it comes to Americans in the outdoors. And I'm really excited to hear other members of this panel and even the last panel and my director, John Jarvis, make it one of his, a major focus of his is reconnecting people and making our lands more relevant to everyday Americans. And one of the big challenges is, and something I learned and heard from the mouths of the young people I've worked with, is how could you expect young people, old people, anybody to care about the great outdoors if they don't care about their own community and their own environment? And I think that's essential, is how can we first inspire them to wake up in the morning and think about what can I do to improve my community? And I think that's one of the major things that's missing. That's why they're not engaging any farther than their houses, because they don't necessarily care about the outdoors right in front of their outdoors. And one of the big problems is I've heard when it comes to young people, everyone talks about technology and the computers and the video games being a major point of conflict of why they're not engaging in outdoors. And I'd like to challenge that. I don't think that's necessarily what's the only thing. One thing that I see in the young people is the academic pressure that they're under to get ready for college and to have their resumes look amazing before they even turn 16. How do they have time to go in the outdoors if they're spending so much time preparing for college? And not to suggest that's not important, but it's to suggest an opportunity for partnership and an opportunity that those of us in the leadership positions who want to engage people, who want to preserve these places for the outdoors, we need to meet young people and communities where they're at and what their situations are. We can't always expect them to come to us. We can't always expect them to absolutely love the opportunities we offer them in our own mind if we didn't engage them first in what those opportunities should be. And that goes to my last big challenge is I'm honored to be here, and I think my presence here is a signal of the seriousness of truly engaging young people and different types of communities in our work, but I don't know how many people under 30 are actually here. And is it because we think they're not qualified? Is it because we think they don't care? Is it because we think they can't handle this kind of leadership and opportunity? I say no to all three of those. There are young people absolutely qualified, absolutely passionate, and absolutely deserve a right to be here to talk about this on a national level today. And I know there's logistics on why that couldn't happen. I know there's a lot of meetings on how to organize this thing together, but this is a constant challenge that I see many organizations, many convenings, many people have of they want young people to care about the environment or the outdoors, but they're not willing to give them a giant blue chair on the on the stage. And so opportunities is really a change of culture, a change of how we what we see what we think young people can do. They can service is absolutely important. Doing restoration work, learning about the land is absolutely important. But they could also be ambassadors. They could also be the teachers as well as the learners. They could help us make decisions. That's what we need to do. We need a change of culture in basically how we engage young people in their communities. And when you think of partnerships, I think it's absolutely important. At the Golden Gate National Parks Conservancy, where I work, we have a beautiful partnership with the National Park Service. And it presents so many opportunities because it's really allowed us to find these intersections of how to connect our parks to the people. So we're not necessarily just mandated just to, okay, we got a round of a bunch of young people, have them working in our parks. We get to think about what those young people are really needing, and what they need is employment. They need to opportunities to practice their leadership skills. That's what we heard from community members, and so that's what we provided, is employment opportunities from young people as young as 11 years old to college-age students to actually earn a stipend, receive a chance to learn about professionalism, and to basically have their first job opportunity in a national park. And that kind of thing is an extremely real experience. To have your first job in protected lands is something that's irreplaceable and they'll remember for the rest of their lives. And I think that's it for now.
All right. Thank you, Ernesto Pepito. Thank you. Thank you for your leadership and for your example. Thank you. Thank you. Now to Sally Jewell and to Governor Richardson, my question to you is this: economics. You know, a year ago, 14 months ago, we were losing 700,000 jobs a month. The focus has been on the economy. Everybody says, how can you really deal with these issues of conservation and the outdoors? Why should we even care about those things? We've got other things to care about. So talk to me, jobs, economics, and the outdoors. Sally Jewell.
Thank you. Well, I'm pleased that there are several members of my industry that are out in the audience, and other than the amount of time I'm going to be spending on an airplane, also pleased that next week we're doing our Outdoor Industry Association Capital Summit, where I will be going with Will Manzer, who's my counterpart, the CEO of Eastern Mountain Sports. You might think of us as competitors, but we actually consider overscheduled people who spend too much time doing homework or perhaps screen time as a real competitor, and trying to figure out what we can do to help welcome more people in the outdoors. So we'll be working together on that. The North Face is also represented here in JanSport and the association itself. One of the things that we learned, particularly over the last 8 years, is the economy talks. And so the industry actually did a study called the Active Outdoor Recreation Economy that tried to quantify the impact of active outdoor recreation, hunting, fishing, camping, cycling, horseback riding, all manner of things outdoors. And it's surprisingly, perhaps to some of you, a $730 billion industry. That's enormous. And certainly for a number of the states, like New Mexico, it's a very, very important thing that draws lots of people into the state and employs lots of people, like the REI employees that work in our two stores in the great state of New Mexico. But when we call on our elected officials, we're now going in with a state-by-state list of the employment and of the sales tax revenues and federal tax revenues generated by the outdoor recreation industry, and it's very significant. The other thing the industry just finished in 2009 is Outdoor Recreation Participation Report, looking by demographic segment at who is participating and who isn't and the underlying reasons why. So bringing the outdoors into people's everyday lives is a very, very important opportunity for us as business people to connect people to nature close to home, like in the parks in Newark that Mayor Booker talked to us about. So it's a growing and very important part of our economy. The National Parks, NPCA, National Park Conservation Association, did a study, said for every $1 invested in national parks, returns $4 into the local communities in economic opportunity, and that is the gateway communities, you know, the food, the beverages, the overnight stays, the concessionaires, the gear that they buy before they go into the great outdoors. Thank you very much. Hope you all got your dividends. So it's a very, very important part of what is the infrastructure for a very large segment of the economy. And so I am proud to be part of an industry that works with so many of you in conservation to give back, recognizing that we have shared goals, that of supporting conservation, supporting healthy lifestyles close to home and far away, and doing that in a way that actually creates, in the case of our industry, 6.5 million jobs, about 10,000 of them at REI, but 6.5 million throughout, so.
Thank you, Sally. Governor Richardson.
Well, I first want to ask Sally, I'm going to be leaving office. I may need a job at REI.
No problem. Yeah, absolutely. You're on.
You know, I think she said it, Sally said it extremely well. I would only add that I know we're not talking about renewable energy and other efficiency measures, but obviously the tremendous potential of a green economy, what President Obama's been talking about, is going to be massive, new, green, well-paying jobs for this country. And the key there is technology. And I was going to, I didn't answer the previous question, although I just gave this thing. But I think a big danger that we have in job creation and making sure that we get into a green economy and creating jobs is we need bipartisanship again in our environmental policies. We don't have it in this country. You know, we're going to face a lot of these issues that are so important, cap and trade, climate change, a new energy bill, whatever. If there is a way that we can bring a new bipartisan conservation ethos, that's going to be critically important.
Governor Richardson, I agree with you, but let me push you just a little bit on this question. Here is jobs and New Mexico. I don't have the statistic for New Mexico, but I know for Montana, 11 million visitors a year, but they only have 1 million people in population. I know the great places in New Mexico that people go and fish and hunt and bike and hike. What does that all mean to a governor relative to the economic wherewithal of your state?
Well, for me, it means gross receipt taxes. It means jobs. You know, we're trying to develop a new ecotourism plan for our state instead of focusing on traditional tourism where you link recreation and wilderness to culture and the Native American tribes. I think we have to think differently also. But to me, as a governor, And our state, compared to others with unemployment, has done relatively well. But our strong basis has been the fact that we have excellent hunting and fishing and trails. And, you know, the wildlife corridor that we created between us and your state is going to mean more tourism, more sustainable hunting. It's going to mean protecting the habitat of the elk. That's tourism. That brings in jobs. That brings in. I would also just one last point, Ken. The stimulus program for governors for states was great, but think if there is another one, and I don't know if there is, of a CC civilian conservation plan for people hired around the country.
Very good point. Let me just bring Gary into the conversation. You know, Governor Richardson spoke about the wildlife migration corridors that he and Governor Ritter from Colorado have been working on. And you spoke with eloquence about what the place will look like in 2050 with all of those wild spaces disappeared. How do we connect up the landscape so that we have the kind of wildlife corridors that Governor Richardson and Governor Ritter in Colorado have been talking about? When you look at the nation as a whole, how do we connect them up? You have public lands, you have private lands. You have state, local lands. How do we connect them up as a nation?
I think your LCC idea is going to be real helpful. And it's partnerships is what it is. The hard part for me, I've looked at things from the wildlife perspective, and I want to do that. What do the wildlife need to be here 50 years from now, all of them, over in, say, the Lower Mississippi Valley. Figure it out, let's see what it looks like, and let's see if we can do it. And leaving the landowner out, leaving the mayors out, leaving the politicians out, and you get in trouble doing that. That's not the way you do it. You really need to work with the communities. You need to work with the mayors. You need to involve everybody in some of these decision making.
So having the ground up cooperative efforts with stakeholders around the table to be able to connect
yes,
up the landscapes.
Yes,
lots of partners. About.
And then there are very bright partners. These guys that live in these places really know them. And we need their input as we develop what these landscapes should look like.
Gary, you and I are a little different generation here than Ernesto Pepito. He raised the point. We don't have a lot of young people involved with us yet. Here others talking about the time for a new civilian conservation corps for America. How do we bring in young people into the great outdoors? Given your history, what would you be your recommendation?
Well, I think that in our business, we're interested in the hunting and fishing side. Come and buy a license, help us manage this resource. If you quit coming, you quit buying a license, we go out of business. We need these kids. So we need to, as a wildlife agency, to keep our fees as low as we can practically keep them. We need to eliminate the barriers as much as we can with age restrictions and things like that. And I think that we need to work with our industry groups, like, what is it? There's a, I guess, Scholastic Sporting Clays, where you work with some of the shooting industries, and you put that in the high school, and you have competition. And it's one high school competing against another, girls shooting these guns. In high schools, lose the fear of guns.
Well, starting them early.
So, but a partnership with all of the different branches of industry, a partnership with the different sportsmen's groups. Ducks Unlimited has a program where they work with kids. I trapped turkeys in Colorado when I first went to work for the Game and Fish there, and my job was to just catch the birds, move them somewhere else, turn them loose. And I did that up on the Uncompahgre Plateau. Nobody saw me doing it. Then 30 years later, here comes the Turkey Federation to Nashville, and they want us to go trap some turkeys, and they want to bring the school kids out, and they take the school kids and hand them a turkey. This is what a turkey feels like. Here are the spurs. Here's how you age them. This is a boy. This is a girl. Turn them loose. Those little kids ate that up. And I'm thinking, I never thought of that.
So those are great experiences. Now, Ernesto, I want you to respond here to how we do that with more young people. You're representing the young people of America here today. I think probably everybody here would say that's probably our biggest challenge, is how do we get young people involved in this great marvel of the planet and the great outdoors. Let me ask you the question more specifically. Are young people in this country, from your point of view, interested in these kinds of things? I mean, you know, in our own Department of Interior, we've tried to create our version of a 21st century land conservation corps. We have 15,000 jobs, millions of volunteer opportunities. How best do we go about reaching out to young people to connect them out here? Are they interested?
They absolutely are interested. And I think I'm a perfect example. I didn't grow up loving America's great outdoors or even going camping or even recycling or anything like that. That wasn't a part of my culture growing up. And it was that simple introduction through employment, through a summer opportunity, that really engaged me for a lifelong dedication to this work and working with young people. I personally would love seeing young people catch turkeys rather than shooting at a shooting range, but that's my personal opinion. So I challenge the idea that young people are different than they were before. I believe young people are still excited, can still be inspired by the same things that they were 50 years ago. And so going outdoors, having a chance to play, having a chance to have a park in their neighborhood that's safe, having a garden in their neighborhood that they can learn about where their food comes from, these things are things that aren't different, in my opinion. They just need the opportunities, and It's unfortunate because I think we get so caught up in restoring this land that we forget about who we're restoring this land for and who's going to protect this land later. So I just think a reinvestment in young people as far as their leadership and true engagement, not just for a photo op, not just for a volunteer opportunity on one Saturday, but a true long-term relationship with a young person and young people in general, we'll get this done quickly.
Thank you, Ernesto. Thank you. Bill? Sally has a comment, but Bill, let me ask you this from a historical perspective. You look at the Civilian Conservation Corps, it was one of the cornerstones, if you will, of bringing this country out from the brink. How do you replicate that now in the year 2010, where we get young people involved in the work of the great outdoors?
Well, I think we look to the inspirations of the past in part. We've talked a lot today about Teddy Roosevelt's era, and I think we sometimes forget that he was actually grappling with some of exactly the same concerns, and here I'm agreeing with Ernesto very strongly. The moment in the early 20th century that he was addressing was worrying about kids becoming too urban. I mean, he actually was precisely worried about where are kids going to have nature experiences, and there's a movement in the early 20th century called Nature Study, which transforms school curricula across the United States. Any of you who grew up planting beans and mayonnaise jars in schools and planting those, we're doing nature study curricula. And Teddy Roosevelt also founded the Country Life Commission to try to think about kids on farms and try to figure out what life in rural areas would look like. The CCC is part of that tradition, and in my generation, I grew up riding the interstate highways to get to national parks and wilderness areas in the West to first experience New Mexico, first experience Colorado, and have my experience out in those landscapes. I think one of the biggest challenges is not just the lure of the virtual and the screened reality that a lot of kids grow up in. It's actually that we now fly to get to destinations rather than to travel the ground that lies in between, where you get to know the whole American nation. So for me, one of the virtues of programs like yours or like the CCC is getting people out onto all parts of the land, not just to particular locations, but experiencing what stewardship work in interior, in agriculture, on the federal lands, on the private lands, in cities, in rural areas, in wilderness, how kids can know that they can make a difference. Because the last thing I'd say, just to support Ernesto again, is the kids really want to believe that they can do something real, that they can really make a difference, not just a play thing, not just a school thing, but really make a difference. And there are few more real projects in the world than sustaining America for the future. So think in all the work that everybody in this room does, asking how your agency, how your organization can give kids real experiences. This is your point. Real experiences where they can make a difference, where they can know that they're doing something that changes the world. That's what this inspiration does. That's what the CCC did.
Sally Jo?
Yeah, I have spoken with the secretary before about, is there a way we can bring back the CCC? And of course, the Army was involved. It was all men, most of them 19 years old. They did incredible work, but what was so clear about that work was a lifelong connection to place that our prior panel talked about as well. One of the most famous politicians in Washington state history, our three-term governor and then Senator Dan Evans, was telling me a story not too long ago. He's now in his mid-80s, still very, very active. And I've been involved in this program called the Mountain to Sound Greenway, which is a green space along the I-90 corridor, rapidly urbanizing area, and was talking to Dan about our work there. And he said, you know, every time, Sally, I drive along I-90, I look for my tree. I look for my tree. And I said, your tree? And he said, yes. He said, I have a tree that you can see as you drive along I-90. That's now 72 years old, or 74 years old now, because I planted it when I was 10 years old. So that connection to place that affected Dan and affected the CCC is something that Ernesto is doing in the Golden Gate Conservancy. The Student Conservation Association is doing in national parks and local lands all around. Earth Corps in my neck of the woods is taking young people out. So it's not maybe the same way it was, Mr. Secretary, with the CCC, where the Army helped mobilize, but we have the CORE Network, a nonprofit group of youth conservation corps all over this country that are making this happen. And I just want to give a nod to Raul Grijalva, a congressman from Arizona, for the legislation he just passed on the Public Land Service Corps in the House, a companion bill in the Senate by Senator Bingaman that begins to bring this back. But if we can mobilize as conservationists, environmentalists, and business people to support the kind of work that Ernesto does, we can have the kind of impact I think that the CCC did by leveraging these partnerships with nonprofit organizations, because the kids are out there, they want to work, they're underemployed or unemployed, and they don't have the connection to land that many of us wish that they would have, and this is just a way to help our crumbling infrastructure as well as provide jobs and connections to that place. So there's just no better thing, I think, that we could be working on.
Thank you, Sally. Thank you. To the two bills, Bill Cronin and Bill Richardson, just very quickly, and just very quickly because we're at the end of our time, historic and cultural preservation. It's a big issue for this country, huge economic development. You know it from your history, the city of Santa Fe. What role does historical, cultural preservation play into what we ought to be looking at in terms of the future of America and its outdoors and our young people?
Well, I think everybody in this room can tell from what I said first that for me, the project of protecting history and culture and protecting nature are not separate projects. They're not divided from each other. They are the same project. And that same project is heritage. It's about reflecting on where we came from as a nation. That's what our history is. That's our shared story. However much we may have conflicted with each other in that story, it is finally the story that made us one nation, one people, out of many, one. And so cultural and historical preservation is about making sure that the benchmarks of that journey we've made together, whether they happen in nature, whether they happen in cities, whether they happen in culture, we recognize at all times how they're connected with each other. And it's a very powerful story. It's a very moving story. And learning how to help Americans remember the ways that they can tell that story together, that seems to me to be what one of the core missions of certainly the National Park Service has had from its founding act. And it's what a lot of the interior projects have always been about helping Americans remember who they are. That's what shared heritage, shared culture, shared history is.
Thank you, Bill. Governor?
And that means, too, obviously, the importance of historic and cultural preservation in a state like mine, a multicultural state with great traditions. But as part of that, I want to emphasize one important point, and that is that about 20 years ago when I was a congressman, I had a very good relationship with the environmental community, but I made them mad once, very mad. I said, you're all asking me here to, I think it was the Malpai, make it a national conservation area, and I liked that idea, but you're a movement that's lily white. I don't see one Hispanic, Native American, African American among you. And what are you going to do about it? And I think I have seen in the last 15, 20 years a very strong integration of minorities in the environmental movement. And I mention it because if we're going to have bipartisan support, but if we're going to have a base of conservation leaders, it has to include the people that Cory Booker talked about in Newark. It has to include my friend over here. It has to include the Native Americans that, you know, they hesitated engaging because they're worried about sovereignty. And you know, this is the enormous delight that I'm sitting next to the first Hispanic Secretary of the Interior, a proud generational leader in the West. And I think that's what I see of the real importance of historical and cultural preservation is who we are, bringing us, all of us, into this movement.